The Tom Woods Show, episode 2289.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm delighted to be joined once again by our friend Gary Chartier. And I want to revisit a work of his called Understanding Friendship on the Moral, Political, and Social Meaning of Love, which I have linked at tomwoods.com/2289. Gary, the original reason I wanted to have you on, though, was because I wanted to talk about your book, which I think, forthcoming book, which I think is called Christianity and the Nation State.
That's correct, Tom.
Yeah. And I guess I thought that book was out, and it wasn't. And publishers are not really that excited about you going out and publicizing a book that people cannot get a copy of. So I thought, well, I've already bothered them. Let me see if I can get them on to come on and talk about something else. And I know at least a couple of years ago, because I had you on for a whole week, we did talk about friendship, but there's so much to say here. And it's such a rich topic. And in a way, given the state of, let's say, political discourse and the state of society, talking about friendship and love is almost countercultural these days. So I thought it wouldn't be a bad idea to revisit that. So that's what we're doing.
Excellent.
All right. So first of all, let's think of it in terms of the philosopher that you are. What kind of philosophical challenges does the idea of friendship raise? I think one of them has to do with the idea that we get, I suppose, from the Christian tradition, but we also see it in the Stoics, the idea that we are to pursue something like universal benevolence. And if that's the case, then how do we justify the kind of particularity that's involved in friendship, where we're showing special favor to a handful of people? I don't actually know how the Stoics reconciled this. I've seen them talk about we're all one people and this being citizens of the world and all that. But then they also say very beautiful things about the value of friendship.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question in the history of philosophy that I'm not sure I can answer. I
mean, yeah, right. I'm not sure either. And maybe they never tried. Maybe they never tried to reconcile that.
You know, I mean, Cicero obviously is quite influenced by the Stoics and also writes a great deal about friendship as one of the sort of foundational Western texts in that area, De Amicitia. So yeah, I'm not sure how that all comes together. I'm interested in the book in a range of things. I start out trying to think about really the nature of friendship, what we mean when we talk about friendship and what sorts of puzzles there are related to kind of the focus of our friendship with each other. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Then I go on to think about issues in ethics, politics, and spirituality. The ethics issues are, of course, just the ones that you've highlighted, especially. First of all, does it make sense to talk about obligation in friendship at all? Some people think the answer is no. But if we can think about obligation in friendship, then how does that relate to more general or indeed universal obligations? With regard to politics, we know that Plato, Aristotle, Cicero all think about friendship as politically important. We also know that they're accustomed to reflecting on this in the context of a world in which there are small numbers of political actors, say, in classical Athens or even in the Roman political world, and friendship groups can be quite important in those small settings. Does that mean that what they have to say is irrelevant in our world? And I think the answer is no, and I try to suggest a number of reasons why. I do think, as you've hinted, the most immediately salient thing I actually do in that chapter is to think about how friendship can be understood and sustained in an environment in which there's a great deal of polarization that leads people to demand ideological conformity from their friends and what I call political idolatry. And so then after talking about that, I reflect on the nature of friendship and spirituality, drawing on a number of relatively contemporary thinkers, including some very fine Catholic thinkers like Simone Weil and Karl Rahner, to reflect on how we might love God in and through our love for friends and so forth. So I try to do a pretty broad range of things in the book. It's a book that started life as a doctoral dissertation many years ago, has gone through a lot of rewriting since then, but continues to reflect my, I guess, overly broad, perhaps dilettantish interests.
Well, that's, you're describing myself too. And I don't know if that's because I have not enough of an attention span to be like the world's foremost authority on the social history of the 1920s or something like that. I just don't have the patience for it. I have too many interests. And so I like being able to pursue them. By the way, I'm sorry, Gary, when I introduced you, I really didn't introduce you. So let me back up for a minute and say that you are you still a professor and associate dean at the business school at La Sierra University?
That's correct, Tom.
And you have a doctorate from Cambridge in what field?
So I finished in 1991, a doctorate in the Divinity Faculty at Cambridge that involved work in philosophy and theology, and then added to that a doctorate for published work in 2015, also from Cambridge, with a focus in legal theory.
Okay. Now, so with regard to this subject of friendship, with so many topics that are entertained by philosophers, it can be fruitful to go back and see what Aristotle thought about it. Now, Aristotle, of course, has a famous taxonomy of friendship that you seem to feel like it leaves you a bit cold and doesn't give the full and satisfying definition of what a friend is. Maybe say something about that.
Sure. So, I mean, we need to be very modest and humble when it comes to responding critically to classic texts in this or any other area. Here, we're thinking about the work of, again, of Aristotle, probably the most important figure, but certainly also Plato and Cicero. I don't want to be at all dismissive of Aristotle's typology, but I think that typology focuses on something that's, I guess I would say, a bit different from what it seems to me, at least many of my readers, I think, will be interested in. It's not that you couldn't have relationships of the kind that Aristotle talks about and call them friendships, but Aristotle, I think, is very interested in the way in which we can have relationships that involve participation in common projects, particularly, say, the common project of making the polis hum. And that's important, and I don't want to be in any way dismissive of it. I certainly don't want to trivialize it. But it seems to me that it's also important to recognize the degree to which friendships for us involve mutual knowing and connection for its own sake. So in what has been undoubtedly one of the most influential 20th century texts in this area, C.S. Lewis's The Four Loves, Lewis talks about a distinction that he finds important. It's certainly influenced by Aristotle, which he says, lovers are face-to-face, friends stand side-by-side. And his conception is that friends are united by some shared common interest. And then as a kind of incidental matter, they discover each other along the way. And I'm not sure that was true for Lewis himself as an historical matter. I don't think it's true for me, and I don't think it's true for a lot of other people. It seems more right to say that there are various occasions for our becoming friends, and shared interests can certainly be among those. But I think once the friendship develops, then I think it moves beyond that initial occasion. And it's not that we necessarily lose interest in that which occasions the friendship, but the friendship, I think, becomes valuable for its own sake.
And even if one of you lost that interest,
yes,
the friendship exactly would very likely persist.
Yes, exactly. So it feels to me as if that's an attempt, you know, what Lewis is doing, I think, is kind of an attempt to sort of modernize what I take to be that Aristotelian view. And it feels to me as if we might benefit instead by focusing on the way in which not only the friend, but the relationship can come to be valued for its own sake. And while we don't abandon or ignore that initial occasioning connection, it's not the only thing that matters.
So how would you define friendship?
Well, I'm interested in this book in close friendship, and we know that in English, especially in American English, maybe even more so, we use friend very broadly, right? I mean, a friend in American English may just be somebody we know and don't dislike. I guess I hope in this book to help us understand especially those relationships in which we know each other well and in which we integrate each other into our own kind of priorities and self-understandings, right? It can sound a little clumsy, but the idea, I think, is that you're my friend. We've moved beyond the stage of acquaintanceship or even just kind of casual initial friendship. If I know you well, interacting with you, knowing you, connecting with you is a priority. And I think us together, not, I'm sure, as intimately and consistently as we might think together, romantic partners or spouses. It's not that kind of we typically, though clearly in history we can see some examples in which it's very hard to tell the difference. But at any rate, something approaching that, a sense in which if the close friend is somebody my relationship with whom is pretty integral to who I am. So we start out with liking and knowing and move on to a kind of connection that's integral to who we are.
I have known, I won't name names, but I've known some people in my life who, through no fault of their own, I think that friends are people who come to your house to play cards and you have a nice time and then that's the end of it.
Yeah.
And I think probably growing up, that was the impression I had, that that's really what your friend is, somebody you have a few laughs with and that's the end of it. And, but then as I've gotten older and my friendships with at least several people have grown much deeper, I realize what I would have missed out on if I had treated them so instrumentally, if I had really thought that they're just for fleeting pleasures here and there, which I guess, by the way, is an Aristotelian category.
Yes.
That I enjoy somebody for that, just for that. But now I have before me this in your book here, maybe I read it too long ago, but when you talk about C.S. Lewis, who seemed to suggest or speak against being vulnerable with your friends. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that that's not Lewis's official view, and it certainly isn't, I think, finally a fully adequate account of his own friendships. I think, like all of us, Lewis is a complicated figure, but I feel as if, and maybe I'm just unfair to Lewis, and there may be people listening to this who know Lewis's biography well who will point out ways in which I've been inaccurate. But it felt to me in writing about Lewis on friendship as if by focusing on this shared common interest that he took to be central to friendship, he was trying to give the reader a way to affirm friendship while maintaining some distance from it. And I think Lewis's own friends probably thought, first of all, that he should have been more willing to engage that way. I remember in particular, one of Lewis's biographers mentions the way in which Tolkien was a little frustrated because when he wanted the Inklings to maybe talk with him about some issues that he was experiencing at home, Lewis kind of quickly breezed past those. Lewis's friends, I think, weren't ecstatic about the way in which he wrote about friendship in The Four Loves. You know, I think perhaps regarding that as the least satisfactory chapter of the book, even though perhaps in some ways it's the chapter that's had the most attention attracted to it over time. So Lewis was a guy who, in fact, really valued friends and friendship, but who found a way to write about friends and friendship in a way that it seems to me reflected maybe some personal discomfort on his part with vulnerability. I mean, Lewis himself would be very frustrated with my attempt to psychoanalyze him, and I don't want to make an argument that's rooted on that kind of attempt to make sense of his emotional life, but it feels to me as if his practice of friendship was better than his theory.
Yeah, which is sometimes for many of us that what we do in our actual day-to-day lives is better than how we sometimes express ourselves.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So when I think about, again, friendships that have meant something to me, especially, let's say, in the second half of my life, what's been rich about them is feeling like I'm genuinely and fully known by that other person.
Mm.
That I'm open with that person and that I'm willing to, you know, at the risk of sounding trite here, to be vulnerable, to talk about my weaknesses, my fears, my insecurities, because for a long time, I'm a pretty good advice giver. And so my friends would have some problem and they would come to me and I would give them advice. And it dawned on me one day, I never ask them for help. Mm. I never tell them I'm struggling with something because I wanted to project this image of the invulnerable Tom Woods, right? Everything's going perfectly well for him. So he doesn't have any problems. But that's not, what kind of a friendship is that? And so when I dropped that act and that persona, the person who has never has any problems to talk to his friends about, boy, the friendships became a lot deeper after that.
Absolutely. And I think, obviously, there's no magic solution to the challenge that you were wrestling with. I mean, we have to get to a point at which we trust our friends and at which we trust ourselves enough to kind of handle things if a disclosure to a friend doesn't go well, right? We can't know in advance how it's all going to play out. We have to be willing to take some risks, and we have to know that we've got the ability to stay grounded in the face of those risks. And it can take a while to do that. I don't think it's surprising that that wasn't your experience as much in the early part of your life. I think we grow more comfortable in our own skin as we get older.
Yeah, no question about that. You spend some time looking at friendship in a theological light, but do you believe we can understand and develop a robust understanding of friendship in a purely secular way?
Well, I guess it's a matter of degrees, right? So, I mean, I think if you believe that the right way to make sense of reality, ultimately, the right way to understand ourselves and our world is, in theological terms, in terms of faith, then I think it's always going to be the case that there will be some dimension or aspect of what we're saying about friendship or anything else that's insufficient if it doesn't incorporate, at least in some way, attention to that ultimate horizon. So I want to be careful about that. That doesn't mean, obviously, that we can't expect people to be friends with what we might finally judge to be insufficient understanding. I mean, one of my favorite biblical passages is the affirmation in John 1 that the Logos, who becomes incarnate and as Jesus of Nazareth, the Logos is the light that enlightens everyone. So if we think that the Logos is present and active, we can expect people to understand and to be enlightened, even if they don't perhaps have all of the insights that we might want ourselves to have or want them to have. So there's a tightrope to be walked here. You don't want to be dismissive of the understanding and the experience of people. On the other hand, you do, I think, want to say that if creative activity and love of God serve as the ultimate horizon for finite reality, then understanding friendship certainly means understanding it in light of that horizon.
This might be a tricky one to answer, but just going on your gut instinct, do you think the average person misunderstands what friendship is?
Well, I don't know. The average person is a pretty varied kind of person.
Well, okay, I'll rephrase it.
Okay, sure.
Could we benefit from a deeper understanding of friendship?
Sure. So the answer's got to be yes. Now, we want to refer here to a very important philosophical distinction from 20th century philosophy of language and so forth between knowing how and knowing that. So we might think that people are often better at knowing how to be friends than they are at knowing what it is they're doing when they're friends, knowing in some more abstract or theoretical way. I hope at the same time that understanding more deeply the character of friendship and its connection with other things, its ethical and political and spiritual status, I hope that would improve our practice of friendship. I mean, it seems to me it would be a little odd if our understanding didn't have that effect, didn't inform our practice. So I think people can often get along surprisingly well with inadequate theoretical grounding, and yet at the same time, I think good theory ought to feed back into and inform practice and enhance people's lives.
Well, of course, the book has a lot of theory in it, so now I want to ask an absurdly unreasonable personal question.
Sure.
Which is, over the course of your life, Gary Chartier, have you had a particular friendship whose fruits you could discuss with us for a minute?
Sure. So I treasure my friendships, and I wrote a dissertation about friendship that turned into this book precisely because friendship has mattered so much to me. Let me talk about one friendship in particular not because it's my only friendship by any means, but because it might be especially relevant to this book. And that's, I would say, my friendship with Nabila Bouassal. Nabil is somebody who I had been aware of for some years before becoming friends with him. But when we actually met, when I was a sophomore in high school, I had the kind of experience, I think, that Lewis actually talks about, thinking about his developing friendship with Arthur Greaves, when he has this sense of, this sense that he's finally met somebody who is in some interesting way like himself, in a way that nobody else he's met has been. And I think the discovery as a high school student that there really might be somebody with the kinds of interests in literature and politics and philosophy that I was developing was exciting for me. And I think that relationship, which has continued to thrive over many decades since, has continued to be exciting in part because it prompted me to think in a very self-conscious way, not just about individual friendships, but about communities of friends, and not just about friendship as an experience, but about friendship as a kind of occasion for or object of reflection. So this was a friendship for which friendship has been a dominant theme, perhaps ironically, that's really helped me to think about not just itself, but to think about other friendships over the years, and that certainly, I'm sure, gave rise to the reflection that triggered the writing of the dissertation and then the book. So that's one friendship I'd really highlight very enthusiastically here.
You spend some time contrasting friendship, or maybe your conception of friendship, with the way other people have employed the concept. And sometimes we see it employed with reference to the political community. And maybe the classic example of this is G.A. Cohen, who I guess was a Marxist, and he had a famous illustration of the kind of society he wanted when he suggested that if you belong to a certain political community, you should treat the other members of that community on the basis of the principles and moral intuition that would guide your behavior if all of those people were friends on a camping trip with you. And you object to this as not correct. So it sounds noble enough. What's wrong with it?
Well, I guess because I think we're not all friends on a camping trip. That's really the the simple point.
Yeah.
We're not all close friends and we're not on a camping trip. We interact in a broader social environment with many people who are casual acquaintances or strangers, who are engaged not in the kind of shared project that a camping trip is, but in many, many different projects. And I think the diversity of those projects and the lack of the kind of intimate connection that a group of friends on a camping trip might have make the analogy that I think Cohen's trying to draw there really in a posit. But Cohen, I think, here is typical of people in a number of contexts, in a political context, but certainly we also see in some religious contexts, people want to try to move from the experience of friendship, which, if it really is going to be rich and textured, is unavoidably going to involve a relatively limited number of people, to the big picture, as if we could be in the same way friends with everyone. I think that doesn't reflect an accurate understanding, again, of the different kinds of projects and commitments that people have and of the actual relationships that we have to those projects and commitments, the way in which we might share or not share those with others, the intimacy that we do and don't enjoy with others, and so forth. We can absolutely extend love in important senses to everybody, but we have to recognize, I think, the variations that come with degrees of intimacy and variations in commitment and so forth.
Is that because human beings are finite and that it would be nice if we could have exactly the same kind of relationship with everybody? Or even if human beings were angels, would we still have friends?
Well, so it certainly is not because of some kind of moral deficiency on our part. I think it's not a sign that we're less than perfect that we have particular friendships. if we were all angels, of course, we would still be finite. We would still have limitations. We would still have particular projects. To not be finite would be God, and creatures in the nature of the case are God. And
see, it helps talking to a theologian about these things. Yeah. Cuts right through to the essence of the question.
You know, so yeah, I just think our finitude is nothing to be shunned or be embarrassed by, and it's just part of being a creature. There's no way to escape that, and it's part of the way I think we've been created.
One final question. I would think most people, not being philosophers, don't pause to reflect about big questions like this, about what is friendship. And they might even think that it's a lot of nitpicking even to try. So why is it enriching for us philosophically to explore something like friendship that seems to come so naturally and maybe not require any extended reflection?
Well, there are several reasons. One, I think, is just that understanding is itself enriching. Just knowing more about who we are in the world is itself just on its own a good thing. But also, I think understanding more is helpful because friendship comes under challenge in a variety of ways. Something that really is deeply valuable in our lives gets challenged by social pressures, cultural attitudes, and by the ideologies that I think are sometimes in the air. And as I've suggested, for instance, right now, it seems to me there is a lot of enthusiasm for the view that people who don't embrace my ideological commitments of various sorts are not just people who differ with me, not just people I might hope would agree with me, but people who, because of their disagreement, show themselves to be morally bankrupt and worthy of condemnation. I mean, I feel like that attitude, and I don't think I'm exaggerating particularly in talking in those terms, is deeply toxic. It messes up the relationships that people have. It builds barriers. And one of the things I certainly hope to do in a book like this is to reflect on the importance of friendship and the ways in which we can kind of think our way past that sort of toxic barrier construction.
Well, the book, once again, is Understanding Friendship on the Moral, Political, and Spiritual Meaning of Love. We barely scratched the surface, but the purpose of these book conversations on the Tom Wood Show is to get you go reading the book rather than saying, I listened to that podcast episode. All my questions are answered. So you can check out this title at tomwoods.com/2289. Gary, thanks so much.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, folks, that is another episode of the Tom Wood Show. I will see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Wood Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.